Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, salam.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel with the New Books Network. I'm your co-host, Shahnaz Haqqani. Today, I speak with Dr. Amina Wadood about her latest book, Once in a Lifetime, published in 2022 with Kantara Press, a book that started out as a blog for her Hajj journey back in 2012. Dr. Amina Wadood is Professor Emeritus of Islamic Studies at Virginia Commonwealth University. She earned her PhD in Arabic and Islamic Studies from the University of Michigan in 1988. Her other books are Quran and Woman, Rereading the Sacred Text from a Woman's Perspective, published in 1992 with Oxford, and Inside the Gender Jihad, Women's Reform in Islam, published with One World in 2006. The book is rooted in her experience of the famous five pillars of Islam through a feminist, inclusive, and faith-centered lens. Each chapter includes relevant experiences related to the theme of the chapter, such as her specific experiences at Hajj, or the gendered nature of certain Islamic rituals and the ways that common understandings of these rituals might affect women. In our conversation, we talk about the theme of the masculine and the feminine that figures throughout the book, the gender of God, the Islamic concept of Tawheed, monotheism, or unity of God, and its relation to fractals and nature and the cosmos, and her experiences at Hajj, which serve as the basis of the book. But mostly, I attempt to utilize my time with her to hear her speak about her journey through the last several decades as a Muslim academic committed to social justice and faith. The book's accessible and approachable style makes it especially useful for undergraduate religion courses, including certainly Islam and Islam and gender-specific courses, but any religion course. Anyone interested in personal journeys in religion, Islam and gender, Islam and religion would also benefit from this book. This here is my interview with Amina Wadood. Assalamu alaikum. Hi. Thank you so much for joining me to talk about your wonderful book that I was just telling you I read nearly in its entirety in one sitting, Once in a Lifetime. So I'm so glad to have you. And I'm a bit intimidated. I don't know how this is going to go. I was thinking about, this is like a once in a lifetime opportunity to get a chance to talk to Dr. Wadood, the giant of Islamic studies that everyone knows and respects and loves. And, you know, it's a huge responsibility for doing this. So I'm nervous.
Well, the inside scoop is you were one of the first people in, like, you know, the next generation, you know, from me, maybe even two generations, who made expressions about my work that I really felt she really gets it. And I had felt so misunderstood. So I trust that this is just going to be fine. It's my honor and my pleasure to be here. And, this is going to be a nice opportunity to just talk about this book and this process.
Oh, good. I'm so glad to hear that. No, I've assigned your book, Quran and a Woman, which was for me personally life-changing and professionally life-changing. I cannot think in any other way now. And I've assigned it in my classes. And sometimes I assign it at a point after the students have had to read more very challenging, less easy to understand texts. And so they are grateful for your book, your arguments there, your interpretations and the theories that you use and your methods. I simply cannot imagine any other way of doing research now and approaching the Quran. So thank you for all of your scholarship and for existing and for blessing me with your presence. So the way that this works is that we typically ask our guests to talk about themselves, introduce themselves to us, and talk about their intellectual journey, intellectual background. I imagine everyone knows you already. But if there's anything that you want for those readers who might not be familiar with you and your work.
So I had my 70th birthday this year, and it is also this month, in fact, on Thanksgiving Day, the 50th year since I accepted to become a Muslim, and the 30th year since the publication of Quran and Woman. So I've been thinking about who I am for quite some time this year, and I feel like the blessings of my life are so intense that I just have so much gratitude. For one thing, choosing as an adult, I was already 20, like not legally able to drink, but you know, close enough, choosing something at that age that actually inspired the rest of my life and inspired it with love. I just feel so fortunate. And of course, the sort of main ingredient of the love for me at that time was reading the Quran, to which I dedicated the rest of my life. And I'm still in love with the Quran. So my last name, Wadud, means loving. And, you know, half the planets in my astrological chart are ruled by Venus. So I feel like I'm just like the love bug. However, my ascendant is in Scorpio, which is ruled by Mars, and that's what people get. I'm very tough on the issues that I think are important, and those issues to me are removing the barriers from having a direct relationship with our Creator, who chose us to be born on this beleaguered planet Earth for a purpose. And unfolding that purpose to me is also part of how we relate to the divine, how we conceive of the divine, what we do with the gifts of our life, how we face the challenges. So I have retired from US academia 16 years now. I had moments where I was quite poor, but I was so rich in the experiences of not being beholden to, you know, any kind of institutional framework that sought to limit my potential. Obviously, sometimes I feel that in the context of mainstream Muslim communities, but with 1.5 billion of us, there's so many with whom I do resonate that I spend my time traveling the earth, affirming this sense of gratitude towards the gifts that I've been giving, and also Just being amazed by the amazing people that I have met and been able to work with, like yourself, over all these years. I mean, meeting you at that AAR, that many years ago, I have followed, you know, everything that you do. I just have so much respect for the way that you think, for the sincerity with which you challenge yourself to keep growing within your field. So, yeah, I'm just like, maybe I need a new last name, gratitude.
That's beautiful. Thank you for that. So we met in 2014, and then I think it was in 2015, Amanda Qureshi invited you to you were in Austin, Texas for something, and I lived there for my PhD. And so there was, we had a gathering at our house. It was one of the most spiritually fulfilling experiences of my life. And then, so this book, of course, very different from your other books. It's very familiar language. So it's beautiful. It's just so needed. I was laughing because there were some references being made that I thought I got. So it's really, really very, very accessible, very easy to read book. What got you to write this book now? What do you hope that readers will take away from this? Who do you hope will read it?
Okay, so this book was longer in the making than it might seem, because I actually made the Hajj in 2012, that being officially 10 years while we're rounding off the years. I had an interesting conversation with another senior Muslim woman where I thought, how am I going to manage, what I expect to be the gender apartheid while, focusing on the ritual requirements and also, trying to, reach my heart through each of these steps? So I said, you know, I think I'll just like take some time to think about it and I'll just write. I'll just, you know, sort of like journaling kind of thing about, you know, what the experiences were like. And my friend was like, oh, no, you don't want to do that. You want to just pretend like you're in the 9th century and you just kind of like want to go off and do this. And I thought, oh, no, that's the opposite of what I want to do. So I proposed that I was going to write these blogs from Ramadan of the year that I made Hajj to the Hajj, which is roughly 100 days. And Religion Dispatches offered to give me a site online to do that. And it wasn't my first experience of blogging, but it was the first one where I had a daily requirement to write, to be accessible. And in the middle of it, some publisher in California asked me about developing it to a book. And I said, I can't think about that now. I still have to make it to the Hajj and through the Hajj. And, you know, thinking about a book is kind of another project. But when I came back, I thought, wow, I have all this material. What would be the central theme? What would make it into a book instead of sort of a hodgepodge of writing? And I thought, oh, just focus on the 5 pillars, like reorganize the material so that it fits in terms of those and add material, you know, if it might be needed. So I wrote a book proposal and I dropped the ball. I wasn't able to keep going with it. But when Kantara Press and Beacon Press, small Beacon Press in the UK got back to me about the same project. They helped me. They accepted the proposal that I had written, but they also helped me to organize, you know, the mass amounts of material. And I didn't quite drop the ball, but I didn't keep carrying it. However, to be honest, with the pandemic and, you know, the lockdown and everything, they and I began communication that actually led to the technical steps of pulling it together, you know, having them edit it, make recommendations, having me then go back and go through all of the writings, which, fun enough, getting to read them again, separated from the event, was also very heartfelt for me. But I really think my main motivation is because I am known for the kinds of cutting edge work that I have been blessed to do with regard to thinking critically about social justice and identity in Islam. I think people miss the fact that I have been a sort of spiritually devout person from being raised by, you know, a Methodist minister. I've always been interested in the sacred. And I have always engaged in the awareness that to have that kind of relationship, we must also work on ourselves. And in Islam, that work on yourself is encoded in our spiritual practices. So in a way, this was my opportunity to write about something that people don't usually ask me about when they call me, you know, to speak to their class, to present lectures, to teach courses and that kind of thing. And that was the fact that I see the spiritual part of my development on par with the, you know, gender jihad. So that's the kind of the story about how it all came together. Oh, who will read it? I'm sorry, you wanted to know who would read it. Okay, so as with the blogs, because it wasn't, you know, a Muslim-specific thing, I'm sort of inspired by Toni Morrison, you know, write the book that you want to read. So my main audience is always marginalized persons in the context of Islam. But the context of Islam is not just Muslims. So some of my writing has been beneficial to people who are not Muslims, but that's always been my main target audience. But in this case, actually, my audience is anyone who seeks to understand this gift of life in relationship to the creator of life in a way that is not locked into certain grids of sort of patriarchy, repetition, or redundancy. It is still myself. I'm still writing for myself. But I'm writing for myself, not just as a Muslim, you know, not just as a cisgendered woman, not just as a Black person, not just as a Muslim. I'm writing to myself as a human being in another level.
I was just telling you, the book has a very calming aura about it, as I've always believed that you do too. So that each chapter makes me, like it made me better understand things like, you know, prayer, the importance of prayer in Islam, or the relevance of something like fasting. You know, it's very easy to say, what is up with this discipline stuff? I can just discipline myself in other ways. It's very easy to say, you know, why do things have to get this technical? And it's really beautiful to see your interpretations of some of these technicalities. You know, that brings me to ask, my partner is a physicist, and he wanted to know when he first saw the book, and I hadn't read it yet. I hadn't gotten to the point where you talk about fractals, but he got really, really excited about it. And he found that, you know, as you mentioned in the book, also that the cover there's a famous fractal called the Mandelbrot set. And he wanted to know if that was a coincidence or if there was some reason behind it. So we can begin here with the first chapter and your idea, your understanding of Tawheed and the Tawheedic paradigm, because you're making a really important contribution here to our understanding of Islam and the oneness of God. Would you tell our readers what this idea of Tawheed is, and in what ways it is connecting us to everything in the universe, everything in the cosmos?
Yes. So the coincidence, again, was that my daughter, who actually studied physics, but found that the teaching wasn't spiritual enough, so she ended up getting two masters from a seminary instead. She introduced me to the Mandelbrot set through a series of videos that were out there on it at just the same time that I started making the visuals for the Tawheedic paradigm. And it's just such an amazing synchronicity for me, because being raised Christian, I found that one of the challenges for me intellectually was to understand the Trinity. Lacking the understanding meant that I didn't sort of throw everything out the baby with the bath, as they say, but instead I started looking for other expressions, you know, with regard to it, as I said, my sort of multi-faith version. And then I actually became a practicing Buddhist, which is a non-theist tradition. And with a non-theist tradition, and especially, you know, the practice of meditation, it gave me a chance to let go of a fixation on the male God. So when I let go of that male God and then became Muslim, the first thing that resonated with me was Tawheed. It resolved the issues that I had in terms of the Trinity, but it also, over time, developed, you know, as I would tell you in a minute. But often when we relate Tawheed only to the term monotheism, the focus on, you know, the God is one part, which is only one part of that understanding, is enough of a challenge for people who come from, say, Trinitarian or polytheistic, you know, kinds of backgrounds. So that's enough of a challenge. I mean, just one, you know, I mean, I really dig Callie. How come we can't have her? You know, so it's like, you know, you have to negotiate sometimes about how you're going to deal with just the one and how not to make it seem hegemonic. And that's when I learned to distinguish between hegemony and hierarchy. When I came further and further into Islam, specifically through the struggles of social justice, I did begin to think about Tawheed beyond just the God is one. And that's when I got into, you know, that God is also united. There are 99 names, masculine and feminine names. They're all Allah, and yet they are all coherent into one. So that brought another dimension, and that dimension is spiritual, and I'm still, you know, pursuing that. But the other thing was encapsulating this relationship between Allah's creation on the earth, that is, you know, us and, you know, the planet and all that, encapsulating that underneath the umbrella of Tawheed as a term for social justice. So that means that Allah unites what might seem to be disparate or oppositional relationships. And encapsulating that to this day is the thing that keeps me grounded in terms of Islam. Because, you know, and with the Mandelbrot set giving me all these other visual depictions and understandings of how it works through math alone, I came to understand that we are always working to harmonize what might even be disparate parts of ourselves or disparate experiences that we have or encounters in the universe, you know, with others in community and, you know, families and all that kind of stuff. We're always struggling to, you know, make these kinds of balances. And the thing that actually creates that balance is Tawheed. It is the nature of an organizing principle that has both the power and spirit of creation, but at the same time has the continual presence that allows for us to engage in whatever kind of struggle, to enjoy whatever kind of joy there is, but at the same time still be organizing principle, you know, the breath of life and Nefes HaRahman, you know, in our struggles. So I am Muslim because of Tawheed. And I have learned that people see and understand sometimes visually more than abstractly. And so for me, coming across the Manly Bhatt set at just the time when I was moving beyond the theological understandings of Tawheed into the social justice aspects of Tawheed, as I say, there was the beautiful synchronicity of the universe. So it just seemed like I needed to capture that for this book, which is one of the few places where I have been allowed to align my scholarship, my spirituality, and my social justice in one volume. Sometimes I have to do, you know, sort of like divorce from my spirituality, or sometimes the spirituality is divorced from my activism or, you know, sort of academic pursuits. And I've always been seeking the Tawheed of my own life experiences. So that's kind of how it all came together.
No, that makes perfect sense. And so it's on page 22, I believe that, according to my notes anyway. Have you ever seen, so on page 22 at the last paragraph, you say, have you ever seen computer generated images of a fractal? A fractal is a pattern based on a repetitive mathematical formula that adheres to its unity and form at the most minute levels and when projected to its largest manifest levels. One such fractal, the Mandelbrot set, has been called the thumbprint of God. I teach religion and very introductory courses in religion. And we talk a lot about Confucianism, Buddhism, Taoism, and indigenous religions. And this explanation of yours, this understanding of yours on Tawheed, it connects Islam to these other religions in very powerful ways. And so indigenous religions with, you know, indigenous religions and Confucianism, Taoism, with their idea that everything in the universe is connected, that we're not separated from, we're a part of the cosmos. And that's a part of how we know what the impact of the consequences of our karma, the karma that we collect is going to be. It's an explanation of Islam that I've never heard before, but it just makes so much sense now. So thank you for that. I have to ask, because I feel like it would be a missed opportunity if I didn't, but the theme of the masculine and the feminine keeps coming up throughout the book. And in fact, you ascribe gender to in a very powerful and radical way to Ramadan and Hajj. You know, the Ramadan is a queen and Hajj is the king. And you affirm and you recognize that God has feminine and masculine qualities and attributes. And sometimes you use masculine pronouns for God or feminine pronouns for God. And then also, I believe I saw the pronoun it a couple times, all of which I cherish that. So I'm fascinated by this way of thinking about God. And I'd love to hear some more about, especially this masculine, feminine, the choices that you're making here to sort of gender these important concepts and practices and things.
Yeah, I've been trying to get people, for example, students in my class, to think beyond masculine and feminine as just the gendered embodiment of male and female persons, but to take it into its more archetypal kind of expressions. And therefore I embody gender and all kinds of things. I keep an altar, and on my altar, I have things that are noticeably within the feminine archetype and noticeably within the masculine archetype. And each month at the new moon, I kind of allow, you know, whatever intuitive location of these things and what relationship they have with each other to sort of unfold, you know, on this table. And when I sort of began to internalize the Tawhidic paradigm beyond just the theological into the, you know, political and spiritual, I kind of jumped from the masculine God, the Jalal God, to the Tawhidic, with the intention, obviously, of, you know, sort of like the Taoist. In fact, it was Satchika Maraja's book, The Tao of Islam, which actually was a kind of like an immediate inspiration for thinking beyond the hegemonic binaries. I realized more recently that having jumped straight into the Tawhidic, I had not given enough attention to the divine feminine, to the Jama. And I decided the last couple of years that I was going to go back and I was going to give more attention to that, because the way to best understand the harmony, sort of the Tawhidic unity, is to make sure that the parts are, fully identified and therefore capable of being fully integrated without any hegemony. And I'm still working on that. The reason being that people still struggle with things like, referring to Allah as she, because they think that the Arabic language is somehow some exceptional language, and that the rules of the Arabic language are the only rules that apply to the universe. And so in Arabic, everything has to be divided into a masculine or a feminine, with the exception of three words. And so it does bifurcate the thinking. And so when you start talking about Tawhid, they're still Tawhiding a male god. And they justify that because the generic form in Arabic is masculine. When I tell my students, the masculine form of the word for being pregnant is the master form. But males, the trans, they don't get pregnant, few animal species. But so don't think about it literally. And it's very hard for people to break that gridlock. So I have to accept that unless you face certain challenges, there is a possibility that you will not transform. And so for me, when I watch the evolution of certain things, I find it instrumental. So coming to work at how we conceive of Allah's feminine aspects as essential to the nature of God. I mean, Rahim, or the womb, is feminine. It's always conceived of as, sort of being circular, which is another archetype for, the feminine, from which comes Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim, the most oft-repeated attributes of Allah that's out there. The Prophet was sent, illa rahmatan lil alameen, except as a mercy. So this theme of the feminine is so central, and yet historically so under promoted in the context of Islam. So sometimes tongue in cheek, I like to give people a difficult time by when I throw in the use of she. It's just because I was in that box, and I always, as I said, I went from the masculine to the Tawhidic. So in my head, I can analogously understand the masculine as a representative, not of a male reality or person, but rather as, part of a transcendent being. It is neither masculine nor feminine, or it is both masculine and feminine. And, there's some people who crave that in their heart, but there's some people who are very fixated on the literal reading of the Arabic language, so they can't figure out how to get there. And I do remember that it was a journey for me. And at this point now, there's just no way that I can ever conceive of God as male. But I do remember when I did. So it's nice to grow.
Well, in my objective opinion, I think we should just all use the word she for God, because it includes H-E in there. Every time I use she, I can't bring myself to use he for God. I feel that I'm so fed up of the masculine idea of God, as a man. But every time I've used the word she for God, I've had people say to me, how dare you? God has, he has no, you need to stop gendering God. He has no gender. And I'm like, you literally just used.
Exactly. They don't consider the he to be a gendered pronoun. And that's where it becomes a problem. I also like capital S, sometimes in parentheses, capital H-E, to try to embody, that notion that she includes everything. But I will tell you this, there's also a part of having the healing of our relationship to the male or the masculine aspects, you know, of Allah that is part of the journey. Mm-hmm. In some ways, the experiences of rampant patriarchy for, you know, I think they say 6,000 years or something like that. For those of us who have a certain consciousness, a certain awareness, realize, wow, that's been problematic for so many reasons. When we are limited to the he literal male God, and we start to transform, there is a sense, a challenge that we have to face. But there is also another tawhidic place of arrival where you actually are no longer bothered by it. But you're not unconscious of the controversy and the conflict and the, you know, sort of oppositional, you know, aspects of it, but rather because it's just like I said, I was raised Christian and I had so much trouble with the notion of the Trinity. Now I have like a better understanding of the Trinity than I did when I was, you know, it's like entering my teen years and I first started thinking, is that all there is? Is that the only way to think about, you know, this, you know, transcendent reality? So eventually there is a healing of that as well. It's interesting.
That's one of the things that I loved, that I've loved about your work is this acknowledgement of journey. I'm finally at a point in my life, and this is also an inspiration from you, where if somebody doesn't like my work, I'm okay with that. If somebody doesn't like my YouTube channel or the videos that I post or the arguments I make, I have finally come to a point where I can just peacefully and calmly say, you know what? That's okay. This is not for you right now. Maybe it'll be for you in the future when it is. If it ever is, you're welcome back. But it's also okay that it's not. It may never be. And that is such a relief. I don't have to try to convince somebody about my way of life and why I am, you know, why I choose to believe the ways that I do. But speaking of this journey stuff, then how have your ideas and prayer, fasting evolved in your journey to throughout Islam?
Yes, it's a mercy and a blessing to experience different locations with regard to these. When I first became Muslim, I was so in love with Salat that, you know, I used to hurry off. I was in the city of Philadelphia, and, you know, I wanted to hurry off to the mosque so I can do two tahiyyat masjids. Greetings to the mosque, four sunnah, four nawafah, or extra prayers before the four obligatory, followed by the two after. It's like the more units that I could get in, I was just smitten by this performance. And then Allah took the love of Salat away from me. And it was a struggle. And I had the same experience with the fasting. Oh, I was just so into the fasting. I mean, I once voluntarily fasted for 2 months. You know, I felt like I was expiating my sins. So it wasn't just voluntary. So the idea that there is like a romantic period with regard to some of these things, and then there might be a separation, even a divorce, is to me part of the journey. And accepting that, and at the moment, I try to offer consultation to people who are struggling, you know, sort of with the basic rituals and everything, to be patient with the transformations that occur. Because even in those transformations, as long as, you know, it's like when I had the sex talk with my boys, it was different, you know, with my girls, you know, it's like, I know you know what the rules are, you know, so let me just tell you what mine is. Never compromise the integrity of yourself and another person. We know the rules. We know the 5 times prayers. We know the names. I live here, you know, the Adhan is called, fortunately, beautifully, from several mosques within here. We know this part, but that doesn't mean that we are synchronized to the depth of our being at every occasion. For a long time, after being just so smitten, so in love, so head over heels, when I entered into this other phase, I couldn't reconcile it, you know? I mean, I was even kind of angry with God that, you know, the love didn't keep going at the same level. So I think the metaphor of the journey, first of all, Sharia comes from Sharia, street. It's a pathway that leads to Allah, or, you know, classically, the path that leads to water or the source of all life, which for us, the source is Allah, right? But also tariqah, for the Sufi tariqah, it's a path. The way, the Tao. Taoism means way. And so I do see life as a journey, And the purpose of the journey, the goal of the journey is for us to fulfill our purpose. And that purpose is as individual as the cells in our body. And yet, when we find it, when we resonate with it, there is a moment of the shining, brilliant light of Tapi that we experience in ourselves. And those are the milestones, the markers, you know, for, you know, increments in your life. And sometimes those increments are ones you have to come back to because you're like a little higher up on the mountain, or you've been through the river, or, you know, whatever the other metaphors of journey, you know, that are out there. But in my estimation, at the ripe old age of 70, I feel like I try to wait to see how long it takes my mind to think I'm awake now and it's a new day, and then to express gratitude. Thank you, Allah, for giving me another day so I can try towards, you know, the completion of my journey, you know, of this, of the purpose of my life. I try to make that a conscious affirmation as soon as the brain kind of remembers, you know, what's going on in wakefulness, because some people think that the objective is the goal towards which you are journeying. And I used to have that perspective, but actually it's the journey itself. It's the movement towards the end of that life, the purpose being fulfilled, the meeting with Allah, et cetera, et cetera. And in this, using these terms about motion, it allows me to accept that sometimes the road is rocky, sometimes the pathway is blocked, sometimes you have to scale up very high, the air gets thin, you can't breathe very well. It allows me to then take all the moments, you know, you get to the top. I just came from Mount Bromo for sunrise. And the pictures that I took there, they look like paintings. The sky is just so amazing. And the view is just so awesome, you know. So sometimes you do experience those wow moments, but you can't linger in those wow moments, to be honest. You have to come back down the hill and, you know, pay your bills and read your students' papers and blah, 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 you know. So I think the journey metaphor is helpful because I don't see it, you know, we think about the Sirat al-Mustaqim as being just like literally straight, but also actually if you're moving towards what is your purpose, the purpose for which Allah created you and which allows you to return to Allah, you know, itma'inna, with the confidence and, you know, that kind of thing, your journey is going to take all the twists and turns, but it will be straight towards where it is you're supposed to go. And as you make those turns, even when you come to, you know, a cul-de-sac or a dead end, you will simply say, oh, okay, well, this is not the way to go through. I'm going to have to find another way. And you just keep on going. And I like that because, you know, with every breath that you take, you're breathing for Allah, you know, Allah is breathing through you. And to keep that sense of vitality in life, the other thing that helps me are metaphors about movement. So the journey metaphor, it may not work for everybody as well as it works for me, but it works really well for me.
The journey metaphor is so powerful. And it is, it's also, and again, because of some conversations that you and I have had, and especially the interview we had, I think that you did with Fitna a couple of years ago when the pandemic first hit, your discussion of journey made me realize that that's Islam's focus, right? As you've pointed out, is this journey too. So Islam is less, you know, God is less interested in the destination, in the conclusions that we'll make. And this is a huge part of why all of these scholars' opinions are quote unquote correct. They're all valid. And the expectation is that they're doing a struggle, right? It is supposed to be a struggle to figure out the best possible way to be a Muslim, the best possible meanings, to extract the best possible meanings from the Quran. That is why ideally the conclusions are great, and ideally they're correct, and ideally they're, you know, compassionate and good and inclusive, but sometimes they won't be. And the idea was that the journey was supposed to be the more important focus. And so I think it's such an applicable metaphor. And, you know, I kept, as I was reading this, especially, the idea of the five pillar approach to this book, or method of this book, of organizing this book, I kept wondering how Shi'i Muslims might read this book. right? So there's this idea that I, you know, that I've started to think more critically about, you know, framing Islam or teaching Islam as a five pillar approach. And whereas for Shiites, for example, the prayers would be 3 to 5 times, or the Hajj becomes complicated because of, you know, Iran and Saudi Arabia, or because pilgrimage is not just to Mecca, it might also be to these important sacred sites and so on. And of course, the fasting times will be different, the breaking of the fast, because of interpretations of what is sunset and what does the Quran mean when it says the thread of something about the light and the darkness and so on. I would love to hear your thinking on this. How might what should a Shi'i person look for in here, or how might they still feel represented and included in this study?
Yeah, I'm happy to, re-identify with more details and then sort of say a Sunni Sufi journey, because while I am aware of some differences, I'm not familiar to the level of, you know, sort of spontaneous comfort with all of the differences. And as such, I tend to identify this book as more about my personal journey, and therefore, as I said, you know, sort of hyphenating the name, I think, is appropriate. I don't feel like I was sufficiently inclusive, and that the opportunity to experience, again, this is, I probably haven't said this yet, but this is about the experience of faith for me, but the opportunity to experience, you know, certain aspects of Shia worship has been very limited for me. I've never gone on one of the ziyaras, for example, you know, to Sufi shrines. It's, you know, still something that I can hope for. I do pray with the, begins with a K, you know, the stone.
I use the word turba for it, but for the
turba, turba, yes. Anyway, I do pray with that because I don't have a lot of earth in my birth astrological chart, and I feel like I need that grounding. I feel like I need to like touch the actual material of the earth, even though I pray inside and on a rug and all that. So I put my forehead on that, and that allows me to ground myself, to realign myself with the planet that, you know, Allah chose to, you know, give human life from. I love the idea of the not 5 times prayer, because I do advise people, and I'm taking this advice myself, in terms of how to resume or to pick up a regular practice. And sometimes, you know, the best that people can do. So for me, like I just say, you know, just like take a moment, you know, a couple times a day and just think about Allah, just say Allah, and, you know, that's it. So it's like one word. And then I go into like, maybe you just want to say the Fatiha 5 times a day, you know, or maybe you just want to, you know, so it's like the evolution of a return to the 5-time daily ritual of the Sunni practice benefits from the 3 times a day Shia practice, because if you can establish, you know, morning, midday, and sometime at night, if you can establish that, you've really covered a great deal of your day. If you have been struggling with the 5, if you haven't been struggling with the 5, all this conversation is moot. I know a lot more people, I myself included, who struggle with the 5. And so I can see the benefit of that. But to be honest, I neglected to be inclusive along those lines. And I think it's probably better to just be honest about that and say, you know, this is from the perspective of a Sunni, Sufi, Muslim woman.
Or to claim, well, I don't identify with either, and so this is just the Islamic, because that privilege to be able to say, oh, this is just the Islamic view. No, that's unfair. No, we'll get that a lot, right? Like, oh, I'm just telling you what the Islamic view is, not Sunni.
No, no.
Like, wait, let's be realistic here.
Realistic. Yes, everything is either Sunni or Shia, to be honest.
Right. I appreciate that. I think it makes perfect sense. This is, you know, this is a journey. This is a personal journey. These are personal experiences. And especially if you've been in the context of primarily Sunni communities, then of course these experiences would be very, very Sunni and shared by Sunni Muslims as well. So one of the things that I found so beautiful about this book and that I loved, and it was, I couldn't afford to skip a page because I was like, wait, what if there's a really fun anecdote there? Or I couldn't even afford to skip the lines or pages because it was just such a fun read that was done in a way where you've got this method, you've got this method of how you're going to organize the book. So you kind of, I know what's coming and I know what the larger theme is. And then as you describe each of these themes and explain your practice of Islam through these themes, you will mention these very powerful moments, right, of experiences, anecdotes, and so on, people that you meet, and of course the significance of gender that comes up, and patriarchy is just relevant everywhere. And I wasn't angry, which is unusual for me, because there's patriarchy in here, right? Because your experiences are going to be, you're going to have to deal with patriarchy so much, and you write this in such a way that I'm not full of rage. And I don't know if that's just because I'm finally growing up, but I wasn't even sad, because sometimes more recently, my response has been when I see such disturbing levels of patriarchy, misogyny, I get really sad instead of angry. But I wasn't even sad. But throughout your Hajj experiences, throughout your, you know, when you talk about atikaf, the prayer experiences, and the very important way, and the fasting, and the very important ways in which these are gendered practices, and women get excluded, and how the scholars decided that women's, you know, when women miss prayers or fast for menstruation, they have to make it up and so on. And you're like, how do they keep up with the math? But how would anyone keep up with the math? But all of that to say, I think that would take a special skill to be able to write this in this book in a way that wouldn't anger me. And that's not to say that, you know, when I do get angry, it's the scholar hasn't done a good job writing the book. It's to say that
it's just that patriarchy is something that makes us angry.
Right. No, but it's that it has, I keep saying this, but it has a very calming tone to it. And it has that like your spiritual maturity shows in it, and it has this. I read it as what can I learn from this about my own practice, and what can I take from this that might be helpful to me personally, to, you know, as an academic and so on. And so to have an academic, a brilliant academic like yourself, write this book and make this, as you said, this is a very personal, very spiritual experience, journey, it is so refreshing. I appreciate it, because I mean, honestly, non-Muslims get to get away with stuff like this all the time. It's when Muslims do it that it's like, oh, we can't take this seriously because this is not academic and so on. And so the academic in you definitely still showed up, right? As I think you pointed out in the beginning, that you're trained to be critical and so on, but that still showed up, and obviously in the way that you're going to write this shows up. But so all of that to say, I'd love to hear, just to make sure that we get at least one question in for gender. I think with the Hajj is probably where it's most, your identity as a convert, as a Black, as an African-American, as an American, as a woman, all kind of culminate in this one experience. What would be some of the main takeaways that you want us to get from the chapter, from the discussion on Hajj and your experience in Mecca?
Remember that the journey of the completion of the book started with doing these blogs specifically because I did not want to be waylaid with the anger or the sadness that I also normally encounter when I have to come up against these things, especially like, for example, when you point out the Sunni centrism of it, it's like, oh, that's actually true. I wasn't as inclusive. Sometimes you're unaware of the impact that some of these things will have on you. They just sort of like fly in your face. And I expected that I was going to have more than one of those for the Hajj. And I was warned by, you know, women friend who had gone before. And one of the ways in which I thought I would try to come to my own peace was to just like journal. And the journal, you know, actually, you know, was turned into a blog, you know, which was in fact published. So that meant that it wasn't just personal. I was also thinking about how do I talk back to these things? So, you know, that was an intentional part of it. But also because to make the Hajj, one goes through all those, you know, those short books that they have to introduce you to all of the rites and rituals, you know, across several locations and several days, et cetera. And they were all so patriarchal and so ignorant of the replication of their patriarchy. I just thought we need an introductory book that does not address these pillars with a presumption of patriarchal privilege. So there were, you know, both of those were intentional on my part. I do think that, I don't know if I remember to say it in here, but when you decide to make this, you know, once in a lifetime journey, even if you make it 10 times, like some people actually do, you want to be more conscious to choose a group that will move forward in this journey with you without in and of itself creating certain blocks. And I didn't have that. But I did come to the understanding at a certain point, especially in the tents at Mina, this is the Hajj that Allah has given to you. This is where you are right now. So if you want to make the best of Hajj, you must make it through this one. You can't make the best of Hajj for the future. In the future, you can try to make a better one. But I mean, you know, so I decided I was going to relinquish my preoccupation of anger or sadness with regard to certain patriarchal restrictions. So I could step back and look at them tongue in cheek when they happen. And they did happen, you know, like, for example, in the tents, the men would come to the women's tent just like little orphans. It's like they couldn't function without the women making their lives okay. And I thought, I don't see the women hanging out at the men's. They're supposed to be so in charge and so privileged. Why is it that they're hanging around our tent? You know, I mean, I didn't have a man related to me. So this was like an imposition just to get in and out of my tent. I had to go to these men trying to get word to somebody who they knew their wife or their daughter or their mother or whoever it was. So yeah, you know, there were certain biases, but, so they're there, they're always going to be there. I don't think in the throng of the participation of the rituals that I had a tremendous pushback on anything with regard to the performance, with the exception of the fact that they will physically remove you from the first floor of the Masjid al-Haram surrounding the courtyard with the Kaaba. These days they'll actually also remove you from the courtyard, but when I was there, they would still let us pray on that courtyard. The fact that you would physically be pushed in a basement or something by these so-called security, male and female, I think that was the worst patriarchal affront that I had. Everything else I was expecting, or I wasn't surprised by, or I wasn't personally bothered by, because I said, oh, I'm going to write about this when I get back to my room or something like that, you know? And so whatever other things that I had, I was able to calculate to the extent that was they were personal. Like, this is just me, I'm tired, and, you know, the line is really long to get lunch or whatever, you know? So I was able to make assessments of things, and I think the principal cause was patriarchy, and even those things that the principal cause was just disorganization, my particular tour group. So choose wisely who you would make this journey with. Test out not only the company in terms of how they promote, but the Saudis have removed that. Now everybody has to go through them. So who knows what that's going to be like for actual, you know, making the journey. But I just felt like I didn't have the company, the particular travel company that I was working with was not the one that really nurtured the Hajj experience equally for the women and the men. So yeah, you have to think about that, because you will be, you know, week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, you know, with this group of people at what might literally be, you know, your only once in a lifetime experience of something. So yeah, you know, I mean, like, as much attention as you pay to picking out socks, you know, pay attention to who you choose, you know? So I think that's probably, I think you can get around it. I think you can have a spiritual experience wherever you are, being alone and an elder, making this Hajj. You know, I did witness other women that just sort of like, they overdid it. So they had to like use a proxy for, say, Rami Jamarat throwing stones at the Satan, or, you know, it's like really think about what could happen because it is physically rigorous. And you really want to have the support that will allow you to participate as fully, you know, as you can in your own body.
Thank you for that. I was going to actually ask, one of my next questions was going to be, you know, advice, but you just gave that for the Hajj part. I've thought about going on a Hajj, but I don't think I'm ready emotionally for what I'm expecting to be a lot of patriarchy. And one of the things that I assign in one of my classes, actually, when we talk about Hajj, is your article on that was on the Feminism and Religion blog, I think it is. And it's a very brief, very powerful article where I think it was the first time that I realized, and now I cannot teach the Hajj story or the Ibrahim and Hajar story without your from the lens that you're talking about it, where I think you say something like, she's the reason we do this, you know, the running back and forth, and women are not allowed to run back and forth.
Like, they have a sign saying women don't run.
The patriarchy never makes sense. I've gotten tired of trying to rationalize any of it, but how is this happening? But
such a disconnect, huh?
Such a disconnect. But again, not to be expected. I feel like if I were to go on a Hajj, I'd be like, yeah, I knew this was going to happen, and I was expecting this. And so, you know, choosing your battles, I guess. So I'm finally mature enough to know that I'm not.
Forewarned and forearms. You're like, it's like, okay, I know this sign is going to be there, but I'm going to pretend I don't read either English or Arabic. I'm just going to run.
There you go. That's one way to handle it. I know we didn't talk about Zakat, the Zakat chapter. If there's anything you want to add there.
I feel like I didn't have a full chapter for Zakat and a full chapter for the Shahada. So, I don't know whether or not it's obvious. There's some things that I had to write as I was editing it. There's some things that were part of the original blogs that were also sort of edited and cleaned up. But then when I thought, oh, you're going to have these chapters with each one for one pillar, obviously I can talk about Tawheed when I talk about the Shahada. That works fine. That gives me more content. But when it came to the Zakat one, it was more difficult, except that I wanted to talk in general about charity. But still, it's pretty thin. Whereas Hajj is like really a lot of stuff.
So some chapters were shorter than others, and the Hajj one. But I think there's something about the way that the book is written, and maybe in the title, that's kind of understood. Mm-hmm. That, hey, I'm going to give a lot of attention to. I think we get like at least two chapters on Hajj. I forget.
Yeah, the editors decided that, you know, they would kind of break it up into two parts.
Which is a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I think so too. So I think the reader knows to expect that. And so I wasn't expecting a long detailed chapter on Zakat, and I wasn't expecting a long detailed chapter on prayer or any of the other stuff. But I did. I thought your discussion of monotheism was absolutely brilliant. And I think that makes a huge contribution, I think, to Islam. And then it's understood, I think, for the reader that, hey, there's going to be a huge emphasis on this once in a lifetime journey. Trip mm-hmm. that I will be talking about, and so that was the thing that I was most excited about, and I couldn't wait to get to, and I love very much. So that's I don't think that's a flaw or anything in the book. As we begin to close, we are asked to ask our guests about what works they're currently doing that we can look forward to in the near future. And you were telling me earlier, and I'd love for our readers to hear about this, or listeners to hear about this.
So I've been trying to promote the integration of serious studies of sexuality back into the fields of Islamic studies. I worked on some things independently, so I started Queer Islamic Studies and Theology, or KIST, as a .com. Now I'm collaborating with a couple of different institutions to actually formulate some courses for 2023. In terms of my own study in theology, one of the biggest challenges for me when I was doing the research project on, Islamic sources in the classical period about sexual diversity, was that I couldn't find definitive answers to certain things that I had hoped just dedicating myself to the study of it would provide. So I need to write about how I came to accept that and what I learned about ambiguity as an aspect of guidance I'm very excited about it. And I just keep, you know, scattering myself between teaching two courses after retirement, which is a lot for me, and you know, servicing my communities, you know, across the world. So I just need to stop saying yes to everything, everybody, and start writing on this, because it's very interesting how that sort of, you know, halal haram mentality, you know, black, white, top, bottom kind of thinking causes us to defer to the places where you can find a specific Quranic word or a specific passage that says exactly what you want, and, you know, blah, 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 or even, you know, a hadith, or even, you know, a sunnah, some aspect of, you know, the law. But actually, there is a kind of, I think Amir Amanullah Dasundi said, you know, something like, you know, this glorious ambiguity. There is something that's happening there. And I want to talk about how it metaphorically actually enhances our capacity to embrace the unknown, and as such becomes a rubric for our guidance. So that's the thing, as far as, like, you know, sometimes I'm motivated by certain topics, and that's a topic that I'm most motivated, but at the more practical level, you know, working on things for queer Islamic studies and theology is some, what I'm looking at.
Well, thank you so much. I can't wait for that. And the theme of ambiguity has been my theme this year, I feel like. You know, Leila's book is all about this idea of ambiguity and sort of uncertainties and so on. And so that's something that I know I'd be very interested in. So because you're here and because I've got your attention now, I feel like it would be a missed opportunity if I didn't ask you something about what advice would you like to give us, my generation of Muslim feminists who are working, who are doing work influenced by yours and things, that, ideas that you started that are still incredibly significant and influential for us?
First of all, I remember another young feminist created a little GIF with pictures of me and two of her friends. And it says, "We are the hero we've been waiting for." I am so inspired by your generation. It has allowed me to continue to do things which at my age, I really should just quit doing, because you have had to see at least the beginnings of some very critical considerations of the way patriarchy has operated uncriticized for so long. You know, at the same time, you've had to also make your way so that you have, you know, a job or a salary or a position in, you know, in the community or whatever it is. So I just want you to know, first of all, how inspiring you are to me. So keep doing what you're doing. The whole, you know, generation, the queer Muslim generation, you know, in your age range, they've been such an inspiration for me. But the other thing that I want to say, which is sort of like, you know, the real crux of the matter, is I truly believe that we each have the capacity to have a one-on-one relationship with our Creator. And when, you know, things get tough, the waters get rough, that is the rope that you want to hold on to. So I would urge your generation to come to peace with whatever it is that is your rope in terms of the ongoing struggle. And not to be shy that it may not be mainstream, you know, whatever way in which you find yourself connecting to the entire energies of the universe, you want to nurture that. You want to light a candle for it, burn an incense, sing a song. You really want to take care of the depth of your soul in the ways in which the mainstream is not doing it, because really, when the going gets rough, you will be floating on that raft. So I think my one advice, you know, would be, you know, take care of your soul.
Thank you so much, Amina, for joining me to talk about your book, Once in a Lifetime. And I feel so privileged to have done this interview with you. So thank you again.
Thank you so much for having me. Also, thank you for your patience with the scheduling mix-ups and everything. Enjoy the AAR. Please give my salams to everybody that you even remotely think I might know, and wish them all well, and wish you well. Hope to hear from you soon.
All right. Will do.
Salam alaikum.
All right. So that was my interview with Dr. Amina Wadood about her latest book, Once in a Lifetime, published in 2022 with Kantara Press. I hope you enjoyed the book as much as I did. Thanks for listening. Salam.